Weight loss solutions are not one-size-fits-all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert-guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Hello, and welcome to episode 216 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
We all like to think of ourselves as rational decision makers, people who constantly choose what to do and when to do it. But new research suggests otherwise. Studies show that nearly 90% of what we do each day happens automatically, driven by habit rather than deliberate thought. That finding comes from a recent behavioral study that tracked people's daily routines for a week and discovered that most actions are performed on autopilot. Another analysis of that same research explains why that might not be a bad thing. Habits, it said, free our brains to focus on bigger problems and often support the goals we actually want to achieve. So, Rick, if most of what we do each day happens automatically, does that mean we're possibly less free than we think? Or does true freedom come from the habits we've already built?
I think it just kind of illustrates the way in which freedom works for us. We have freedom to do quite a bit within the structures of the habits that allow us to take care of our lot of basic needs. Most of what we're doing throughout the day are basic needs, are things that we do over and over and over. So we have the freedom to think about other things while we're doing them, for example. That really enhances our freedom. I'm kind of encouraged by this thought. It also explains why it's so annoying when, for example, I'm not going to name any names here, but say if you live with a person who sometimes doesn't put something back where it belongs in the right drawer, like all of a sudden you have to stop and think about, oh, now where is that? And it interrupts your freedom to think about what you wanted to think about, because now you have to think about finding this item.
Hi, Cindy. How are you today? You know, and it's funny. Of course, I know what today's show is about. And I'm starting off the show by reading, hello, and welcome to episode 216 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast. Flares it. I mean, all this stuff that I say at the beginning of each and every podcast. Yep. And I mean, I guess that's fine, right? But
well, because it allows me to think about what we're going to talk about instead of paying attention to what you're saying.
Well, and it allows me to like not sit here and like do a creative writing experiment every time I'm introducing the podcast.
Absolutely.
That I just have like the same two or three sentences and just change a couple things up and away we go. So, I mean, and then lets me focus. Because if I spent like even 20% of my time like thinking about like this boilerplate introduction every time, that would not be time well spent. And I think that's in some ways how a lot of our life is, right? Is that we have things that most of us do. But I think what we're going to discover as we talk, at least what the position I'm going to take that we talk about here, is that that's why it's so important that we are intentional and thoughtful about the routines we choose.
Yes, it is. It's important that we think of, put it this way, it's important that we carefully construct our lives in such a way that our habits are actually productive and help us to further our goals. And also that we structure in such a way that the habits don't intrude too much, like onto the things that we really want to pursue. And what I'm talking about is I was kind of joking about something not in the right place. But this is, for example, I do quite a bit of woodworking as a hobby. This is why it's like you find people that are like really productive in any kind of craft. They have a workplace that's highly organized so that they've created a habit of putting things into certain places that kind of streamline the process of the work so that they can be more creative and productive. So you can have the habit of doing something in a way that doesn't make you more productive, that kind of hinders your productivity, or you can have habits that enhance your productivity.
You know where I've never been?
Yeah.
I've never been to your office at your university.
Oh, my office is really not very conducive to productivity.
Because it's messy? Because it's why?
I use it mainly for holding meetings and for putting things in places in between going from one place to another. When I have to do creative work, I have a home office where I'll go where I really have to focus because I know I'm not going to be interrupted, so I can do an hour or two. And I live really close to the university where I work. And so I have basically two offices. One is for interaction. One is for like when I really have to focus.
But so the focus office at home, is that a very organized? If a stranger went in there, would they say, Rick's a real organized guy. He has really good habits. Everything has a place. Or, gosh, Rick is, I don't know how he could get anything done, but this looks like just a bunch of stuff strewn everywhere.
It will get a little messy at time if I'm working on a number of different projects because I have papers and books piled in different places. But it's kind of an organized chaos. Like I have different piles of things and I know exactly what's in them. And I also have my books placed at different areas. So things that I'm working on, I know exactly kind of what volume is in every place. And so if I'm looking for a quote or I need to find something on a certain topic, I've got different places in the room where I can just reach over and grab it. For me and the kind of work that I do, that's the kind of working environment I need because I don't want, for example, if I'm writing something and I think of a quote by Emerson, but I can't remember the exact word, I don't want to spend the next half hour searching around, like, where did I put that book, that sort of thing, right? And especially if I'm working on something that's very complex, I will say this for teaching classes also when I'm preparing lectures. I'm pulling together materials from different places. I want to have access to those materials and know right where they are, so I don't have to interrupt my pattern of thought just to pull out a quote or make a reference.
I mean, your work has changed somewhat over the decade you've been in academia, but in a lot of ways, I'm sure it is similar. And these habits that you just described to me about preparing for lectures and such are habits that you probably have developed quite a bit over the years. I can think when I first started my job, you know, and when anybody, I mean, whether you're working at a university or whether you're working at Burger King, I mean, those first few days are so uncomfortable because you have to know where the books are, where the lecture halls are, how the grading system works, or how long you put the fries in for and how often you turn the burgers. I mean, there's a lot of things that you just probably know are going to become habits, but it can be tricky when you're starting off something new as well, right?
It's tricky and it's stressful. Like when we have to devote a lot of time to conscious thought to everything, like finding out, oh, I have to go to the bathroom. Where is it?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like this is like when you're visiting someplace, you know, like it's much more stressful. This is one way we have of dealing with stress is we have a lot of things that are automatic that kind of free us up not to be always trying to anticipate, to try to figure out every little thing.
And we've talked on the show a lot, and I think we both have been lucky enough that we've been able to travel a bit, and your travel often may look different than my travel, but we do enjoy going different places. And part of that is putting yourself in circumstances where those habits that you have every day, you cannot rely on, because simple things like when you wake up in the middle of the night, where's the bathroom? When you wake up in the morning, where's the alarm clock? Where's your phone? All those things. I mean, those are sort of the boring parts of it, but it's also things like, where am I going to have lunch today? What am I going to see today? And I think, to me, those are like the best parts of a vacation. Maybe you're not stumbling around in the dark, but, you know, the parts about breaking through those mundane things or those repetitive things that we're doing all the time. But you're right. If it's a new job or if you're trying to adjust to an entire, it can be a lot different, right? So I guess maybe what I'm trying to figure out here is if there's some times where we like new and different experiences, getting out of these routines that we have, maybe we could try to use that same mindset when we're pushed into something that's new that maybe doesn't seem as fun as a vacation.
It's not only nice, it's really necessary. Like, there's been a number of happiness studies that show us that we need variety in our lives, and that one of the things that the happiest people have in common is they don't follow a strict routine all the time.
Really?
Yeah. That is not to say that they don't have routines in their life. They do.
Yeah.
But they also will interrupt them, like, and go on adventures and do new things. And so, like, if they're taking walks every day, they will not take the exact same walk, right? Or they'll learn new hobbies. They'll take vacations in new places, things like that. There's also a great sense of relief you get when you get back home. So if you've been traveling especially on a long trip, so if you've been traveling for a week or a couple weeks, you get back home and it's just like, you're just breathing the sigh of relief. You don't have to work so hard to do every single task now. And it's like putting on an old shoe.
You know, right? Where all the stuff is in your kitchen and where you kept your favorite book and how the TV works.
Yeah. And there's something about how going to a new place and interrupting our routines that breaks up those habits lets us appreciate how much we rely on them once we get back to them. It also gives us a fresh perspective on, are there some habits we've developed that have been counterproductive for us that we need to change? This is why people often make some pretty significant changes to their life after a vacation when they come back and they kind of have some insight. It's like they come back and they realize, you know, I haven't been doing this one thing like for 2 weeks and I never liked it. Like, why am I coming back to this new place and doing it? So it gives us insight into some changes and adjustments we might make to our routines.
Well, I thought you were going out down a different path there, but you were talking about how times in our lives where we try to make important and lasting change. And it seems like the number one time we try to do that is at New Year's resolutions, right? That January 1st, I'm going to exercise more, eat healthier, and be a better person. That sometimes can work for people, but really the only time it works is if you build in these new habits, right? And I mean, obviously, in these habits, you can't just do for 2 or 3 days and think you got it fixed. It takes longer than that, especially if it's something that really is pretty disruptive. But I just can't help but think of people who I know who I just see maybe how they spend their time or things they do. They've been doing it for a long time. And it's just, you know, that there are certain people who just develop these unhealthy habits. And then we all know people who are just the opposite, right? They have, you almost marvel at how productive they are, how much they can you know, exercise or all these things because they've done just the opposite. And it seems like they have more hours in the day than you and I both do. And I just seems like, and maybe this is just me not spending enough time in self-help sections of bookstores, but it just doesn't seem like we talk enough in our, in my world, at least, and maybe in others too, about how important developing good habits is.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that, that so many of us struggle with is good habits around eating. Part of that is like you have to figure out ways of breaking the bad habits that you don't like, because if you get into a pattern of eating some junk food that you don't want to eat, one of the ways you can break the habit is not have it at home. So that like every time you walk into the kitchen, you can't just reach into the counter and grab some potato chips or something. And so if you don't have those available, so like if you really want potato chips, you have to take a trip to the store. Like you have to put some conscious thought into it and some energy. But then the other thing is that we need to like really change your eating habits. You need to say, okay, what are some really healthy foods I could make that are not too hard to make, but I could make on a daily basis, and then learn how to make them and practice them, have the stuff there and actually do it. And I found like on times like where I want to start eating a certain thing and eating it more regularly, I just have to build into my daily routine the preparation of it so that it becomes, you know, easy to do. It can't be a conscious decision all the time. That's what I'm trying to say.
So I'm going to take that exact example and try to weave in two things, modern science and ethics, mm-hmm. and get your opinion here. You know, I don't want to make this quite as bad as it sounds, but if somebody has like habitually bad choices about the food they eat, most of the time those people are going to be overweight and unhealthy. And I don't necessarily think you or I would say that that's a moral failing, but clearly it shows that maybe they don't exhibit a lot of willpower or self-control. Now, and for a while now, we have had some miracle drugs developed, you know, the most famous being Ozempic, and there are others around them. These drugs have the ability to really curb a lot of these urges. And, you know, I think everybody's results can be a little different, but I think overall, and I've known people who this has been a really helpful tool. That does change your behavior. It's changing your behavior, though, not because you're taking control of your life and making a change. You're injecting yourself with a drug once a week that's sort of making the change in some ways for you. I guess from a health standpoint, those seem like healthy. It seems like a healthy thing, right? We don't think there's no dangerous side effects that we know about these drugs. People are losing a lot of weight, getting off, you know, diabetes medications. All those things are great. But like, should we worry about those type of things from like a ethical standpoint that we, and again, as technology improves, there may be more things like this that we can just like, oh, I'll just rely on somebody else or something else to fix these problems for me. Even if those things work, should we be worried about that?
Yes and no. We should be worried about the environmental conditions that prompt us towards the development of different kinds of habits, and some of them very unhealthy habits. In the United States, one of those environmental conditions is that we're super reliant on really convenient, highly processed foods that are pretty largely unhealthy. A lot of preservatives and additives and carbohydrates that give us a lot of calories, a lot of calories and a lot of trans fats, and not enough fiber, not enough nutrition. And what we know about like a much better habit would be if we had the habit, for example, of gardening and raising our own food, we'd be much healthier.
And staying active in the garden.
That would be a good habit, but we don't. We have the habit of going to the grocery store and picking up foods or going to a fast food store, picking up things that are really convenient. Since we're already in that kind of environment, and it's a highly artificial and structured environment that creates a tendency to eat in much more unhealthy ways, then modifying it with the GLP-1 drugs is another addition of something unnatural in our environment that helps us be a little bit more healthy. I don't see anything wrong with that. What I would say would, like, the best possible solution is let's try to simplify our life in a way so that we're not quite as dependent on the, like figure out a way of taking the unhealthy stuff out of our environment. That would be much better. And I that is one thing that I wish we would have. If we're going to have government subsidies for farmers to provide more nutrition to the U.S., it should be really skewed towards the healthiest forms of food. And we don't do that right now. So I think that would be better than having subsidies for highly processed stuff and then discounts or assistance for GLP-1 drugs to fix the problem of having those highly unhealthy foods.
And maybe sort of a small success story around this is smoking, right? You know, when I was younger and when you were younger, so many people in our lives smoked, and there are very few people I know who smoke cigarettes. And I think,
but vaping is becoming an increasing problem.
That is true. That is true. Smoking is, it was always one of those things that, you know, the survey after survey showed that, was it 90-95% of people who smoke daily would love to quit, right? I mean, that's like a huge number. And it's just, you know, I've thankfully never been in that position, but it must be really, really difficult. And that's where, I mean, some people do have the ability to go cold turkey and just decide to quit and kind of push through and, you know, great for them. But then there's also, you know, things like patches and other nicotine gum and stuff that help them. And I think those are good and useful ways to change really dangerous habits. And also, I think just, I would imagine if you're a smoker or an ex-smoker, actually, being around fewer people who smoke cigarettes is probably better, that you're not as tempted by it. And all sorts of things. You watch old movies, and you watch more old movies than I do, but like smoking was like glamorous at one point. And I think
Paul Henreid and Betty Davis in Now Voyager, that's like one of the most glamorous smoking scenes ever.
Paul Henreid takes
two cigarettes and he lights them in his mouth, and he takes one and gives it to Betty Davis at a point in which she is asserting independence from her domineering mother. And so him handing her the cigarette then becomes a symbol of her act of liberation from her domineering mother. And it's an amazing scene. So for anybody who hasn't seen Now Voyager, or just look up cigarettes Now Voyager on YouTube and you'll see the scene.
And then smoking rates will soon spike across the land.
Yeah, well, I was entranced by the scene, even like as a teenager. But never encouraged to smoke. I grew up watching so many adults struggle with like this really addictive behavior and always trying to quit smoking and mostly unsuccessfully. And I thought, I think I'd be better off if I don't start, right? Thinking that I probably inherited the same kind of addictive personality. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. See, so much of what we call addictive personality, I think, has not so much to do with willpower, but just how we manage our environment and like manage the environment around us. And if you can construct your environment for the formation of healthy habits, well, you don't have the opportunity cost for the unhealthy ones because your day's already filled up by doing all these things that are already habitual, right? And it's not that you have the willpower to stop bad habits any better. It's just that you're already addicted to certain things that are actually quite productive.
Well, and I think that's maybe a good pivot point. There was an essay, we'll link to it in the show notes, called Why Habits Are More Important Than Goals. And the author of that piece makes a simple point. He says, goals can give us direction, but habits make progress possible. And you can maybe relate to this. The author said he didn't finish writing his book until he built the habit of writing every day, even if just for 15 minutes. Well, you've written, I don't know, a handful of books.
Well,
whatever that number might be.
I think six.
Six. And, you know, you don't just sit down and decide to do that. That has to be a habit that you have to get into. And I think you've talked about that. We did a whole show about how your writing process for your most recent book, which is called?
The Search for Meaning, Temporarily, the book.
Oh, there's a new book. Well,
the new book that I'm working on.
Oh, I didn't know. So, oh, okay. Well, first,
so we
of, all,
talked last
well, first
episode.
Of all, we're breaking some news. First of all, let me just back up for those listening. I was referring to your Third Places book.
Oh, Finding Your Third Place is the name of that book, which you can buy right now if you want to.
And then I think, so let's just take people along here. So then at some point when we were talking about your book, I had asked you if you had another book in mind. And a number of months ago, you told me, well, I'm kicking around some ideas. I've not settled on anything. Well, now it seems like you may have settled on something, so maybe you can now break that news to me and everyone else listening.
In our last episode, we talked about the topic of love, which was also, I'm giving a lecture series on seven ideas that I think are kind of foundational to our culture.
And the series called Search for Meaning.
The Search for Meaning. And so that's kind of the provisional title of this new book. The reason for doing the lecture series is to get me started on the book. Because if you just have the goal, you just have the intention, it's easy to keep putting it off because every day there's all these things that have to be done. There's all these emails that need to be answered and everything. If you don't create in your life some urgency, some demand, it's really hard to work on something that is a long-term goal because it's the easiest thing to put off. It's also painful. You know, like it's painful to sit down and work on something like that.
So I want to take readers behind the curtain here a little bit. So you're doing the seven-part series called Search for Meaning, and it is every other week. So quick math would tell me that's over 14 weeks.
Right.
How, and this, when you just finished week, or pardon me, installment three, so you're 6 weeks into it.
Yes.
How long ago did you put this on your schedule?
It was during the summer.
Okay, so you scheduled this sometime in the summer months.
Sometime in June or July, yeah.
So when you, we'll say July 1st, just to keep the discussion going. You settled that you were going to, these 14 weeks, have seven sessions on this topic.
Yep.
I'm going to guess that on July 1st, you did not have every one of these things figured out and kind of ready to go, but it sounds like you set this schedule and set dates, so you kind of forced yourself to get moving. Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely. I thought that will give me enough time to do some initial work on each one of the lectures, so by the time I get to fall, because these are scheduled for September, October, November, I'll have the initial work done, so it won't be that hard to finish a lecture on each one. By mid-August, I really hadn't done any work on them. I came very close to canceling the whole series.
Really?
Yeah. But I didn't. So, for example, I've done... So next week, I'm doing one on the topic of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a lot of work to do on that yet. But this is the very reason I scheduled it. Otherwise, I wouldn't make progress on the book this far in advance.
But you aren't forcing your deadlines work.
I'm committed to this, and we're going to have like about 100 people show up, and I'm publicly embarrassed if I've got nothing to say,
mm-hmm.
right?
Or you just figure I'll just wing it when I get there.
Yeah, that doesn't work. So. Winging for 5 or 10 minutes is okay.
We do that all the time on this show. Yeah, that's nothing new there.
Yeah. Well, and you can always rely on the other person to say something for a while. Like if you're up there on your own, I find public embarrassment is such a great motivator. And so I'm putting myself in the position where like I really have to do something on it. And that will get me going. And that will force me to develop a daily habit of like for the week before that lecture of doing some work on it every day.
So that's the habit you've now created for yourself over the past few weeks as these deadlines continue to pile up.
Yeah. And Sometimes I really enjoy it. Days where I don't have a lot of other commitments and I can fit it in. There are days where, like, my days are just so packed with teaching and other things I have going on that, like, finding time is really hard. That's where you need the habit to carry you through. And so I think you had mentioned, like, somebody talked about writing a book. They create the daily habit, even if it's 15 minutes a day. I find that to be really true. Like, if I can find a small amount of time each day, then I can continue to make some progress each time. If I take several days off, I come back to it, and it's like starting all over again. And then it becomes really hard. I think that's true with anything we do. Like, people who are like working out, doing strength training, they take some time off. It's like starting all over again. But if they're doing it on a regular basis, people that run, like anything that we do, if we do it regularly, we can keep the pace up.
But you mentioned that you don't want to be, and you won't find yourself in the position where at the last minute you either A, have to cancel the night's lecture because you just haven't done your work, or B, you'll walk up there with just the vaguest notion of what you're going to say, and you're not going to put yourself in that situation because you're motivated, like you said, by the 100 and some people sitting out in that room. Not everybody's can be motivated by that, though. I mean, is it important for each person to, if it's not a room full of people where they're going to look silly in front of, is it important for people as they're creating these daily habits to find something to motivate them? Is that a necessary component to being successful?
Yes, and generally what works best is to change something concrete in your external environment so that it's not just trying to find a motivation in your head. That's why I had to create the lecture series that required me to actually go out in front of people. I'm creating a change in my environment, so I've got this commitment every other Monday night.
Versus just putting it on YouTube and hoping somebody watches.
Yeah, or just like putting it in my calendar that like every 2 weeks I'm gonna have something done by this date. Because if it's just in my head, you know, or just private, I can change it. It has to be in my external environment. But I remember years ago hearing a lecture by Ken Blanchard, the leadership author, talk about how he had for years wanted to make a change in his life where he prayed on a daily basis. And he would always fail in the intention. Until one night, one morning, he got up in the morning and couldn't find his shoes. And he was looking around for his shoes. He got down on his knees, looked under the bed, and he had accidentally kicked them under the bed. And he realized he's already on his knees beside the bed. He thought, I'm down here on my knees. I can pray. And then that night when he's going to bed, he thought, I'm going to slide these shoes under the bed again. Well, he gets down on his knees to slide the shoes under the bed and thought, oh, I could say a quick prayer now. By putting the shoes under his bed every night, he began the habit of praying twice a day in the morning and the evening. But the key was where he put his shoes. And that's what I mean. Like, it can be something, it doesn't have to be something big like committing yourself to a public lecture. It can be something where you just change where you put something, right? But some kind of change that disrupts your routine so that you can't just change your mind or forget about it.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, I hear you have a question for me.
Okay, Scott, this is a real life dilemma that somebody asked me a couple weeks ago. She said that her son's getting married at a small venue and there's only room for a certain number of guests. So her son told her that she can invite 10 people. Well, she has a friend group, and this friend group all know her son and have known him since he was a little kid. And she has 10 friends on the list, so that's how many she can invite. But ordinarily, they would want to come to the wedding with their spouses. So her big question is, Does she invite 10 of them and say they can, they're invited, but they can't bring a partner with them? Or does she say, I'm only going to invite 5 of them so that they can come with their spouses?
I mean, ideally, right, you would love to have 20, but you don't. You don't have room for 20, but you'd love to have 20.
Yep.
My thought would be, and if these are close friends of yours, I think you are just extremely transparent about what's going on. The first thing that you, I think a bad situation would be is that you decide sort of all by yourself that you're going to just invite your 10 friends and tell them for reasons that you hope they understand they can't bring their spouses. But then like a week later, you learn 5 of those friends can't come anyway, or they'll be out of town, or, you know, there's some other thing that keeps them away. I mean, it's unlikely that you're going to have all 10 of those friends being able to RSVP yes anyway. So I think what I would do is start like doing some conversations about, you know, oh, we're still working out the details, but the wedding is going to be, I'm assuming it's a ways out, you know, next summer. And do you think you could be there on, I don't know who, all the details, but does June 12th look good for you? And if you sort of like start putting the feelers out there and realize that there is going to be like 8 or 9 people saying yes, and then I think you have to contact them and just explain just what you did to me, mm-hmm. is say, here's the situation. I mean, it sounds like it's pretty clear that the spouses in this case are not as close to the son and the family. I'm also going to probably assume that this friend group, many of them know each other. So they're not going to be sitting there all alone because their spouse can't come. They're not going to know another soul at the function. So I think that problem probably isn't likely. So I think if you're just open about this and say, I guess when I started talking about the whole, well, trying to decide how many of them can actually go. Well, let's say 7 can. Well, then do you invite 7 and then 3 of the spouses? That's weird. So maybe upon reflection, maybe that's not a great idea, because I just don't know. I mean, unless you just get down to 5 somehow, I don't know. So yeah, I think you just say, here's the situation, and you'll understand when you get there, but it's a very small venue and we're just really limited in size. I just can't imagine that the spouses are going to be too upset and that your close friends are going to be too upset if you just clearly explain this to them. And you said, is this the wedding or the reception or both?
I think it was both.
Okay. But I mean, ideally, of course, that you might have more room at one than the versus the other, where you could have a little more flexibility. But if you can't, then I think you just have to be really clear about that. And I guess can't imagine people are going to be too unreasonable about that.
I guess some of it depends on if there's travel involved, sort of thing too. But it probably isn't if you're inviting friends. There's probably a local event.
Yeah, that's a fair point though. I mean, we have gone to a number of weddings I can think of in Colorado and elsewhere that, yeah, we're happy to go to the wedding, but we're also going to kind of like make a 3 or 4 day trip of it, right? If you're going to go to Colorado, you don't want to be there for more than 24 hours.
And even if it's like a 4 or 5 hour drive, something like that, if it's a bit of travel, yeah, like you.
And then I guess, you know, your spouse comes along and you can make a joke. Well, you know, have fun, you know, going to the hockey game or whatever you're going to do while I'm at the wedding. I mean, I guess I would hope that everybody sort of understands. And maybe, you know, with the magic of cell phones, you could like do a fun little FaceTime call. Here we are. I hope you're having a good time. You know, we miss you. That kind of thing.
You know, I like your answer, because the first thing I thought of is sometimes we create a dilemma in our minds where there really isn't one once we ask people what they would like.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you're really transparent, you have this friend group, you talk to the friend group and say, this is the situation. if you have several that say, I don't think my spouse wants to go anywhere.
Well, I was thinking that possibly, right? Too.
And you might be thinking, of course, they would all want to come with their spouses. And, you know, and frankly, there's nothing I dislike more than going to a wedding where I don't know either couple. Like, my wife knows, of the children, but I don't know them at all.
That's why spouses should never go to high school reunions, by the way.
Right.
Unless you're from the same high school, of course.
Yeah, okay. But because you know nobody there.
Yeah.
But the transparency part is good because you talk it over with people and say, like, well, what do you all think? And a solution might come about that everybody's happy with, and you're thinking you have to make a big choice for other people where you really don't. It's pretty obvious once you ask them.
So here's the one thing I was thinking about is, and I can't imagine I'm the only person who thinks this way, but if I were invited to a wedding, you know, in a big city, in the poshest hotel in town, and you walk in and there's a string orchestra playing. I mean, it's like, you know, top of the line stuff, right? I've not been to a wedding like that, but they do exist. I've just never invited. And you sort of know going in that it's going to be this really sort of over the top thing that you're, and then let's say the next weekend you're going to a wedding and everything's in the church basement of a small town outside of where you live. Do you feel, I'm turning your dilemma back to you. Do you feel compelled to buy a more expensive gift to the posh affair versus the simple one in the church basement? Because some people sort of look at that as a transactional thing. Like, well, you know, this was a plated dinner and there's like a string orchestra and it's a very expensive venue and all that stuff. So I feel like I'm going to drop a few dollars more on the gift than if it's just like the church basement. Does that enter your mind? And then I have a follow-up question.
No, it does not at all.
Okay.
No, like the nature of the gift for me, and I think my wife feels the same way when we give a gift, it depends on how well we know the couple who's being married.
And then so thinking of it more as if you were looking at it as a more of a transactional thing, that there's two of you going, you maybe feel, well, you know, they're paying for two plated dinners and two glasses of champagne and whatever it all is, that your gift may be more substantial than if you were, would it be more substantial than if you were just going alone?
You know, I never thought about it that way. And I don't, like.
You don't think most people do?
I don't know.
Okay.
Like, it's honestly, it's never occurred to me. And I don't spend a lot of time thinking about wedding gifts.
And I don't either. And I guess all the weddings I've been to, I would say were very much like in the middle of, you know, I've never been to like a super simple one, nor have I been to one that has the string quartet. So I guess I have a, but I would think that if I weren't invited to that first example I gave where it's like you walk in and it just like is like the fanciest thing you've ever been a part of, and you knew that going in, I would feel a higher obligation to like up my gift game a little bit.
You know, when I think of wedding gifts, I don't think I would. Maybe I would. If I ever got invited to a wedding like that. But I always think back at my own wedding, which is like a few decades back now, and we had just a few really memorable gifts. One of them was a picnic basket with some wine and some other things, and it was just a basket, and it was really nice. Like, and we used it several times. I don't remember who gave it because it was my wife's side of the family, somebody like that her parents knew or something. But it wasn't on a registry or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a unique, it stood out because we also got like 20 sets of towels or something. Yeah. Like we had towels.
You may still have towels with tags on it in your house.
Absolutely. Like, We also got a musical candy dish that was a green glass with a silver top on it that played this hideous tune whenever you opened it up. That was memorable because it was just so awful. We had two gifts that really stood out. One that was like, what in the world is this thing? And then the other one that was like a really thoughtful, kind of unique, neither of them very expensive, by the way.
Yeah.
I always think in that way, it's nice if you can to give something that's kind of meaningful and special, but I really do not like the really extravagant, over the top wedding receptions. And I don't like the gift registries.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The people I do.
I understand that people want lists and there's lifetimes, but the reason for that often was that couples used to get married when they were quite young.
And didn't have much of anything.
And they were trying to establish a home. And so they needed basic things, like they needed plates and they needed silverware and cups and all of those things. They needed sheets and towels.
Yeah.
That's not the case with most couples anymore. I mean, some couples do.
Yeah, but generally.
Generally, that's not the case.
In some ways, it's the opposite, where you're kind of paring down two households into one.
Absolutely. I guess I'm a little bit cynical about the whole thing right now. And so that transactional nature of the extravagant reception with pairing it with an extravagant gift, I think, I don't want any part of the whole thing.
But the point back to your kind of tying this all in a bow, back to where we started, that if your wife were going to a wedding without you, I'm guessing if she were in that situation, you would understand and be fine with it. And you would for a minute say, well, I don't think we should get quite as nice of a gift because I'm not going to be having any of the chicken cordon bleu that you're going to be having. That would not cross your mind.
Yeah. Go ahead and get whatever gift you would like. I'm fine with it.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics and even maybe occasionally about wedding gifts. And that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thanks for listening.